Okay, well, electrons are quantum objects, and what I'm going to do in the first few slides is work up gradually to the relationship between quantum mechanics and geophysics. Ultimately, the relationship derives from our desire to know and understand material properties and behavior at these very extreme conditions that we'll never get to personally, that we can reproduce to some extent in the laboratory, but in any case, which we'd like to understand at sort of a fundamental level. In order to make quantitative predictions. I'm going to start from where we were a couple of lectures ago with a very interesting discussion we had about equations of state and finite strain theory and all that, and work gradually from that purely empirical starting point through deeper and deeper levels of understanding to quantum mechanics. I'm going to review a little bit of quantum mechanics and show you what modern first principles theory looks like. Okay, so this is where we were a couple of lectures ago. You start from the fundamental relation, the Helmholtz free energy versus volume, temperature, and number of particles. And if you just want to look at an isotherm, then the Helmholtz free energy is a function of volume alone. And what do you do with this? Well, we don't know what this functional form looks like, and thermodynamics doesn't tell it to you. Okay? All it tells you is that if you knew it, you would know everything about the material, but it doesn't tell you what the functional form looks like. So, you do a Taylor series expansion. Now, a Taylor series expansion is the theoretical equivalent of punting. I mean, it's what you do when you don't know what else to do, right? What we do know is that the expansion variable has to be volume or function of volume, and what Birch chose is the Eulerian finite strain. Other people have tried all kinds of other functions of volume. Anyway, if you do use the Eulerian finite strain, what you find is something like this, where you can account for experimental observations of MgSO3 perovskite with only the first term in the expansion. And as Taylor series expansions go, this is like winning the lottery, because you only need that one term. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it makes you suspect that there might be something deep and fundamental about the Eulerian finite strain. But whatever that is, people haven't discovered it yet. So it's also like winning the lottery in the sense that you win not because of any merit of your own, right? I mean, this agreement doesn't result from any deep understanding of the material. It just happened to work. And the Eulerian finite strain expansion happens to work for almost all materials that we've looked at so far. And so that's why we keep using it, because it works spectacularly well. Okay. But at the same time, we would like a little bit more understanding than this. I mean, we would like to go a little bit deeper than this empirical level. For one thing, we'd like to understand properties besides just the equation of state. We'd like to know the shear modulus and the thermal properties, thermal extensivity, heat capacity, and this approach doesn't necessarily, you have to augment this approach with a lot of other stuff to get those things. All right, so we need to know a lot more than this. So, and the way that we understand materials, I mean, since the 20th century, is on the basis of the sort of microscopic view, where you zoom in 10 to the 23rd times or so and look at individual atoms, nuclei, electrons, and so on. Okay, so a lot of different approaches have been developed to try to relate sort of this microscopic picture to the macroscopic picture. And I hinted at one way of doing it last time using lattice dynamics in the last lecture I gave. But in order to look at all properties, you want to generalize that a little bit. And one way to do that is to think about the forces that interact between atoms and try to model those somehow. All right? We know something about what those forces would look like. And in terms of a potential energy versus distance, what would that curve look like? Well, as the atoms get infinitely far apart from each other, they won't interact at all, so no potential energy there. So it has to go to zero in this limit. As you bring them very close together and start to overlap, then the potential energy has to get very, very high. That has to be very unfavorable. If it weren't unfavorable, all matter would just collapse onto itself, and we wouldn't be here. In between is going to be some happy medium where the atoms are at some ideal distance corresponding to the equilibrium bond distance. Okay, so how are we going to model this curve? How are we going to describe this curve? Well, Born and Meyer, as early as the 1920s, came up with a form that looks something like this. You say this repulsive part, well, the charge density on the atoms, which we'll look at in a second, sort of falls up exponentially with distance. So maybe this repulsive part looks kind of exponential. All right, let's choose that. And if we're looking at an ionic system, then this attractive part is going to go like the Coulomb energy there. The advantage of this approach is that it's really fast, and people do simulations based on this method with 1 million or 10 million atoms these days. Inadequacies include fundamental ones. These, you can show that any pair potential, no matter what parameters you choose and what functional form you choose, satisfies this Cauchy relation, where these two elastic constants are exactly equal to each other. And real materials violate that relation, okay? So doesn't matter what you pick for the pair potential, you're not going to agree with at least this one aspect of real materials. And then there are empirical inadequacies too. There's the problem of the n plus oneth observation. You choose the values of parameters such that they fit n experimental observations, but then an n plus oneth comes along and you're not going to match it usually. And so people try more complex functional forms and or let the parameters depend on pressure, temperature, or the structure. At a certain point, you lose some of the nice sort of conceptual simplicity of this pair potential approach, and it becomes more and more empirical as you add complications to it. And so what you really want to do is think a little more deeply about what is going into these interatomic forces. One very nice way to do this was developed by Gordon and Kim in the 70s, something that has had a significant impact in mineral physics and the study of earth materials. It's an ionic model, but it's a lot better than the last one in the sense that you're putting in some quantum mechanics. Okay, so now for the first time, we're starting to put in some real physics. All right, so what you assume for an ionic crystal is you make this really simple assumption. You assume that the charge density is exactly that of a sum of overlapping ions, all right? And you assume that these ions are spherical, and you assume that they have their ideal charges. So silicon is plus 4, oxygen 2 minus, magnesium 2 plus, and so on. And you assume that the electron charge density of each ion is the same as it is in the free state. Okay, so as you move the ion from the free state into the crystal, you assume that the charge density doesn't change. In other words, you assume that the ions are rigid in some sense. And this is just a pictorial representation of that. We have an anion here and a cation here, and we can represent their charge density. I'll show schematics like this later. So this represents the nucleus here, and these curves represent the charge density. The charge density is very high right at the nucleus, and then it falls off something like exponentially, although that will depend in detail on what ion you're talking about. Okay? And this overlap of the charge densities of the two ions gives you the repulsion, and the difference in charges gives you the attraction. All right. The advantage of this is that it's ab initio. What does that mean? That means that there's no input from experiments into this method. There are no free parameters in the theory. Okay, I've specified it completely there. We can solve for the charge density of the ion in the free state with quantum mechanics. We can do that really accurately now. And then the quantum mechanics is done. Problems are that this only applies to systems that are ionically bonded. The Cauchy violations are still, you don't reproduce the Cauchy violations. In other words, the Cauchy relation is still satisfied always. And another problem, which is particularly severe for the mantle where oxygen is the most abundant atom, is that O2 minus isn't stable in the free state. So this simple recipe that I started with doesn't actually work for O2 minus. there are ways around that, of course, and very clever ways. And one solution that people came up with involved allowing the O2 minus ion to breathe, that is to respond to its environment, and that has the added benefit of then allowing you to violate the Cauchy relations. Okay. The question really comes down to, if you're talking about the mantle, where, yeah, bonding is mostly ionic, whether you should abandon the idea of ions altogether and instead deal with the nuclei and the electrons directly. In other words, deal with the fundamental particles directly. All right? That's the question. The ionic model goes all the way back to Pauling and Goldschmidt, and it's very powerful as a way of rationalizing and predicting crystal structures at low pressure. No, it's an ionic. It's a purely ionic model. I mean, they developed some systematics for... No, bonding the mantle is mostly ionic. Yeah, all the way through the mantle, mostly. Not entirely, but mostly. The basis of this model, the sort of physical picture, is that each ion is a hard sort of billiard ball with a charge on it, right? And so you make crystal structures by packing these billiard balls together. Abby showed some pictures of this sort of point of view in her lecture. The problem comes in when you try to translate this intuition that mineralogists and crystallographers have come up with over the years, over the decades actually, and sort of translate it to high pressure. Strictly speaking, if your ions are billiard balls, then the bulk modulus will be infinite. So, I mean, obviously seismology tells us that's not quite true. Another way to look at it is this argument that I made in the first lecture, that the pressure required to fundamentally change the bonding goes like an electron volt on an angstrom cubed, and that's similar to the pressures in the mantle. So we have to expect that these ions are going to change their size, they're going to change their shape, they're not going to be spherical at high pressure. Their charge will change. There's going to be charge transfer away from the sort of ideal charges. The bonding might not be as ionic as it is at low pressure. In fact, there is evidence that some materials that are ionic insulators at low pressure, earth materials, ionic insulators at low pressure, become metals at high pressure. And that's not something that this sort of Pauling-Goldschmidt model would be able to capture. I'd say one where the dominant attractive force is the Coulomb attraction between point charges centered at the nuclei. Right. Yes. So for a covalent bond, for instance, would be different. You can think of a covalent bond as being caused by sort of a buildup of charge on the bond. So there you're talking about at least one additional point charge in addition to those centered on the nuclei. So it's more complicated.
I always thought of covalent bonds as being spread the orbital out over two atoms. And by increasing the size of the box, you decrease the energy of the electron in the box. And then
does
that gain energy?
Yes.
But in that,
absolutely, and that reminds me to say something else about this picture. on top is the sort of Goldschmidt-Pauling view of stishovite, high-pressure polymorph silica, where the oxygens are the big red spheres and the silicon is the little blue sphere. And I've used the radii for these two ions that are the sort of standard radii that you use to understand quartz and so on. And you see that in stishovite, these radii don't quite work. Strictly speaking, this Pauling-Goldschmidt model says that the cations and anions should touch, and the sum of their radii give you the bond length. instead here in Stishovite they don't quite touch, which means to sort of modify this model we'd have to make either the silicon or the oxygen expand with increasing pressure. And so already we're beginning to scratch our heads. Why should we think of an ion as expanding with increasing pressure? And the real problem, as Don pointed out, is that the ions aren't spherical, therefore the bonding isn't fully ionic. It's not purely ionic. I mean, this is an experimental measurement here. This is a measurement of what the charge density looks like in Stishovite, what the ions really look like. And they're not spherical. I mean, the oxygens are sort of distorted in this way towards the silicon. And one way to think of that is as a bond which is partially covalent, partially ionic. X-ray diffraction. What X-ray diffraction measures are photons bouncing off electrons. That's fundamentally what's measured. Now, X-ray diffraction is often described as locating atoms. And that's almost the same thing because the charge density right at the position of the nucleus is so much higher than the charge density anywhere else that it's almost like locating the nucleus. But if you do a very careful X-ray diffraction experiment with a wide range of energies, you can also measure the charge density away from the nucleus. Okay, so in order to go beyond this picture, we do need to consider the electrons in the nuclei. And what I'm going to do is remind you of some very simple aspects of quantum mechanics, ones that we'll use later to when we sort of make the transition to solids. We'll start from an atom, then go to a molecule, then go to solids, and look at what the electronic structure looks like. And then we'll go into the theoretical methods that are used to determine the electronic structure of solids. Okay, so let's start with the simplest case. And this is the only case that you can solve exactly, actually, unfortunately. I mean, we know what the Schrodinger equation is. We can write it down. As far as we know, it's exactly right. It survived many experimental tests over the past nearly century now, not quite. And for the one electron atom, that is some nucleus of some charge, it can be any charge, doesn't have to be the hydrogen atom, and then one electron orbiting it. All right, what are we going to solve for? We're going to solve for the wave function, psi, and we're going to find several states that the electron can be in, a ground state and several excited states. This wave function can have either sign, can be positive or negative. We're going to use that fact later. And the charge density, which is actually the experimentally observable quantity, goes like the square of the wave function. We're also going to solve for the energy of these different states. And the way you solve it, and I'll make some analogies to seismology throughout. If you look at the equation here, we have the del squared operator, so basically the spatial curvature of the wave function, minus the potential. In this case, the potential is just the Coulomb attraction of the nucleus for the electrons, just minus the charge on the nucleus divided by distance. Psi is the wave function, E is the energy. The problem is spherically symmetric. And it turns out to be natural to describe the wave function in terms of spherical harmonics, the same spherical harmonics that you saw in Guy's talk. And the states then are described by three quantum numbers, the principal quantum number, and then the angular order, and m. And then there's also spin. That's the one thing that wouldn't show up in free oscillations. Yes?
So the complication that comes up in a multi-electron system would be that you cannot exactly define the energy state?
You can define them. You can define them. The Schrodinger equation is still well defined. You just can't solve it analytically because now the electrons are interacting with each other. And the electron-electron interaction is much more complex than the nucleus-electron interaction because the nucleus is just a point charge, whereas both electrons that you're looking at the interaction between have some complex spatial distribution of wave function. So it's a harder problem. you certainly can solve it numerically, and there are tables of solutions for atoms and ions and so on, and as far as we know they're very accurate, but they're not exact solutions. So here are the states. Nothing that you haven't seen before in chemistry. I mean, here's the 1s state and the 2s state and the 2p state, and here are the n equals 3 states, s, p, and d. And one thing that I'll refer back to in a second is that the s states are the only ones with the charge density right at the nucleus, right at the origin. The p and d states don't have any charge there. And the number of nodes is related to the principal quantum number and the angular order L, the second quantum number L. Okay, so S, P, and D correspond to L equals 0, 1, 2. So let me get back to the multi-electron atom. Here's the one electron atom solutions. You have principal quantum numbers 1, 2, and 3. For each principal quantum number, you have different values of L. So 2s, 2p, 3s, 3p, 3d. D corresponds to L equals 2. In a multi-electron atom, in a one electron atom, the energy only depends on the principal quantum number. In a multi-electron atom, the degeneracy with respect to L is lifted. And so 3s, 3p, and 3d get different energies in the multi-electron atom. Why is that? Because of these three n equals 3 states, the s state is the only one with charge density at the nucleus. So you can think of it as having more favorable Coulomb interaction with the nucleus. The p state, in contrast, doesn't have any charge density right at the nucleus, and it's partially screened by the s electron, which now is already occupied, and so the p state gets higher energy, and the d state higher energy still. Okay, and if you put this multi-electron atom now into a crystal field, it's only at that point that m becomes important in terms of separating energy levels. And so for an iron atom, for example, with 3d d electrons, you would split that 3d state into 2l plus 1 or 5 different states. The occupation of these states goes like the rule is that you fill the lowest energy level first, and that rule does just fine. So first you fill the 1s, then you fill the 2s, then the 2p, and so on. And that rule does just fine until you get to here. And then you have to be a little bit careful because it turns out the d electrons want to occupy individual d states as much as possible because they repel each other so strongly. So actually in iron 2 plus and mantle minerals, and Abby showed this before, you don't doubly occupy the lowest d states. You first singly occupy 5, and then the one leftover electron goes in the lowest energy level.
Can I ask a...
Yeah?
For the one electron atom, are you saying that that one electron can go in any of the states instead of just that lowest state?
Yes.
Okay.
And those would be excited states. And the transition between excited states and back to ground state would release a photon, and that's what gives you the spectrum of the hydrogen atom, which is how Bohr initially discovered these energy levels. Yeah?
So when you say that there's charge density at the origin, does that mean that there's a probability that the electron should begin in the nucleus? Or do you have to worry about other forces that
No, in principle you don't. If you think about the probability of an electron occupying some distance from the nucleus between r and r plus dr, that will go like the wave function times r squared. And so the probability of finding an electron right at the nucleus vanishes in those terms. Yeah.
Also, the nucleus is pretty darn small.
Right. Right, and much smaller than the wavelength of the electron. Of course, in quantum mechanics, you have to think in terms of wavelengths. You can calculate the wavelength of anything, including you and I. our wave functions are fairly localized. I mean, the wavelength goes like the mass, and so we're pretty localized. But when you get to very small things, three z squared minus r squared. Yes. And those subscript notations on the d orbitals have to do with the orientation of the d orbitals. Right. That's right. That's right. That's right. So that has to be some finite probability. Okay, so this is atoms. And let's see. All right. So let's look, let's now go from atoms to molecules, and then we'll go to solids. And what we're going to focus on is how the energy levels change when you go from isolated atoms to molecules. All right. So let's just look at, let's say we're looking at hydrogen atoms, actually. Why hydrogen atoms? Because they're simplest. They just have a single 1s electron in the ground state. And the way I'm representing the hydrogen atom schematically here is to plot its nucleus, and then this object here represents the wave function of that 1s electron that the hydrogen atom has. Okay, so the wave function is highest right at the nucleus and decays away something like exponentially away from the nucleus. All right, so that's what that sort of cartoon there represents. Now, if we have isolated atoms, okay, a hydrogen atom on this side of the room and a hydrogen atom on this side of the room, they both have the same ground state energy level. And so the energy levels of our two atom system are, well, there's actually just one, the one corresponding to these isolated atoms. Only as we bring these atoms together do the energy levels start changing. Only as the atoms start interacting do the energy levels change. And once you bring them close enough together, then you end up with actually two different energy states. And the energy of both of these states differ from the energy of the isolated atoms. The wave function can have either sign. And so there are two ways to combine these two wave functions of these two different atoms. One is to have the wave functions have the same sign. And the other way is to have the wave functions have opposite sign. In this case, we're going to get a little bit extra buildup of charge in between the nuclei. You can think of that as Coulomb attraction between the electrons and the nuclei, which is energetically favorable. Okay, so this is a bonding state with lower energy than the energy of the isolated states. The antibonding state is up there, where the wave functions are now interfering destructively. You get zero charge in between the nuclei, and so that's an unbonded state.
You have the same wave function, right?
Yes.
So does it mean that the lower one has the same electron spin?
They would have, no, they'd have opposite spin. So you'd have one up spin and one down spin occupying this molecular state. And the same up there, one up spin and one down spin. Now, in reality, when we bring these wave functions together, the wave functions will distort a bit, and they'll change a little bit. And I've left that out. That's a sort of second-order contribution. Let's see, what else? Oh, the spacing here will be proportional to the strength of interaction. Okay, so how separated these two levels are depends on how closely we bring the two atoms together.
Your conceptualization
of this is just that there's basically the kind of the overlap between the orbital and the negative charge density between the positive and the charge that you have. Yes. A lot of the energy, even at this sort of quantum mechanical level, a lot of the energy is still Coulombic, and you can think of it as Coulombic. Of course, there are other contributions, and we'll get to those. But it's conceptually useful to first think about the Coulomb energy, and the Coulomb energy being more negative in this case because you've got this extra buildup of negative charge.
Yeah, I think that's the detail. But fact that the each orbital ends up having some charge density on the other nucleus around the other nucleus. So basically, the orbitals increase in volume on both sides. That delocalizes the electron, essentially gives it a bigger box going around and decreases the energy. Still the overlap that does it, but the fact that the electrons have more volume to run around them.
Right. So what I've been talking about is the potential energy. What you're talking about is the kinetic energy. The bigger the box the electrons have, the lower their kinetic energy will be. And that turns out, in this case, to work in the same direction as the potential energy, towards more favorable energies. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. All right. Well, condensed matter physicists tend to be impatient. They don't count 1, 2, 3. They count 1 to infinity. So let's do that now. Jump to a metallic solid. Okay, so here we're looking at the electronic structure of solids, and we're going to look at a very simple model of a solid, but this model captures a lot of the interesting things, including the three different kinds of bonding, metallic, covalent, ionic. You could add to that list a few other ones. But those are the most important ones, I think. And also some basic concepts of electronic band structure. All right. So let's think about what a linear chain of hydrogen atoms would look like, what the states might look like, and what the energies might be. All right, well, here's the simplest thing we can do. We just line up all these hydrogen atoms together and give the wave function of each the same sign. And what we have then is a bond between each neighboring pair of hydrogen atoms, okay? So in the case of the molecule, we had one bond. In the case of the solid here, we have as many bonds as we have hydrogen atoms. The interaction between any pair of hydrogen atoms is very favorable, and so this will be a relatively low energy state. This is the bonded state of the solid now, right? You can think of the solid as an infinitely long molecule. So long that the edge effects aren't important, all right? And this is going to have a very low energy. The highest energy state, the most unfavorable state, is going to be that one up there, where every other hydrogen atom has the sign of its wave function reversed. That's a purely anti-bonded state. You can't anti-bond any more than that state is. And so that state is going to have the highest energy possible. On the x-axis is the quantity that we saw in the context of lattice dynamics. Both when you think about phonons and electrons, you work with Brillouin zones and wave vectors and reciprocal space. Many of the same concepts apply. We're going to see folding in a minute. So here's the wave vector going from its smallest value, corresponding to infinite wavelength, to its largest value corresponding to the shortest wavelength. And we can describe these states and all the states in between with this equation up here. U here is a function with the periodicity of the crystal. Okay? So actually this is U right here. U of x is right here. All right? It describes this variation of wave function with position all the way through the crystal. And then all the states from one end of the Brillouin zone to the other are just a modulation of this basic periodic state, modulating it with this cosine kx term. And then the limit that k of wavelength equal to twice the lattice spacing in that limit, you'll get that modulation there of every other atom having opposite sign of the wave function. Okay, so it turns out that you can describe a near continuum of states from this lowest energy bonding state all the way up to this highest energy purely anti-bonding state. There's a continuum of states in here corresponding to, say, every second hydrogen reversed in sign, or every third hydrogen reversed in sign, and so on. It's one way to think of it. Continuum of states. Now, the number of states on here, all right, is equal to the number of atoms, right? We can't, the number of states is conserved. We start out with n atoms, with n states, and we end up with n states. All right? So there are n states in here. Now, electrons have spin, and so each of these states you can occupy with an up spin and a down spin. So you can put two electrons in each of the n states here. Now, we only have n electrons, and so we're going to fill up each of these states here with two electrons, and then by the time we get halfway done, we'll be out of electrons, and so we don't need to fill any more states. And so there's going to be, so all these states are going to be filled with electrons, and all these states are going to be empty of electrons. So there's an energy that divides the occupied from the unoccupied states. That's called the Fermi energy. And in this case, we have a band. That's a thing. That's what this thing is called because it describes a range of energy. So it's a band, and the band is half filled. This is a metal, because there's no gap, there's no energy gap. We'll see a gap in the next example. There's no gap between occupied and unoccupied states. And so this would have metallic behavior. One way to think about it very cartoonishly is to think that the electrons in a state here can sort of jump into an infinitesimally higher unoccupied state in order to move around the crystal more or less freely. Okay, so that's a metallic solid. Now, what would happen if we took this hydrogen lattice and we expanded it, if we stretched it out? Now, you know that hydrogen tends to form molecules. So there's going to come a point where the stretching is not going to be uniform anymore. The hydrogens will tend to pair up with each other into little H2 molecules. So if we stretch this guy out enough, we're going to get a situation that looks like this. Where pairs of hydrogen atoms are closer to each other than they are to the next molecule over. The unit cell size now is doubled because our unit is now an H2 molecule instead of just an H atom. So our unit cell size is doubled. And just as in the case of the phonon dispersion curves, that means the Brillouin zone is halved. And so that nice smooth cosine curve that we had in the last slide is going to get cut in half and folded over. And so here's the lower part of that cosine curve from the last graph. Here's halfway, and then the other half is folded over here, and we get that part there. So we get two bands in this case from this folding, and we're going to get a gap in the band structure. We'll have one band down here, then a gap where there are no states at all, and then another band up there. So we'll have an occupied band and an unoccupied band separated by a finite gap. And this is the characteristic of non-metallic materials, insulating materials, the existence of this gap here. And then one other example. And that is to see what an ionic solid looks like in this picture, in this electronic structure picture. So here's what an ionic solid looks like, where now we have two different kinds of atoms, okay? They're not all hydrogen atoms. We have some cation and some anion, and I've labeled the anion red and the cation blue. And the two extreme states in this case are the lowest energy state with all the valence electrons on the anions here and no valence electrons on the cations. And then the highest energy state would have all the valence electrons on the cations. Right? That's going to be less favorable because the cations want to give up their electrons. And so we can think of two states, one in which the electrons are all on the anions, and another one up there where the electrons are all in the cations. Now, this is, in a way, the simplest band structure that we've seen so far in the sense that the bands are pretty flat. And that's characteristic of very ionic materials where the electronic structure is very similar to that of just isolated ions sort of stuck together in the form of a solid. And it's because the bands are flat that that Gordon-Kim approach that I mentioned, which assumes these overlapping spherical fully charged ions, has some degree of success because the band structure is relatively flat. And that corresponds to these localized ionic-like states. Of course, in mantle materials, which are mostly ionically bonded but not entirely, what happens is that these bands aren't entirely flat, that they do split depending on how many atoms you have in the unit cell, and they disperse across the Brillouin zone. And it's that finite width to the band that gives you a lot of the interesting physics.
So is the energy constant?
It can change with temperature and with pressure. It depends most strongly on just compression, on how much you compress the material. And what happens as you compress the material is that the energy of the states will change, and therefore the energy at half filling will also change.
So in all these cases, as the type of bonding is changing, you would expect the bonding energy to so it's not the same bonding energy, how would it change?
It'll certainly change if the type of bonding changes. If you go from covalent to metallic to ionic, the Fermi energy will also change, yes. Okay, so this picture of electronic structure is the basis for all modern theoretical approaches to condensed matter, including density functional theory. It's that band structure is what quantum mechanics looks like in solids. Okay, I mean, a lot of quantum mechanics deals with atoms and molecules, and when you deal with solids, you have to deal with this band structure, with this electronic structure. And it's shown up in many earth science publications as well, band structures like that. So the most powerful theory that we have of condensed matter at the moment, I mean, it's based on quantum mechanics, but a particular form that's particularly applicable to solids is called density functional theory. And the nice thing about it, which is very different from the two previous types of theoretical approaches I told you about, the parapotential and the Gordon-Kim approach, is that it doesn't make any assumptions about the charge density or the type of bonding. There are no restrictions on the kind of atoms you're able to look at and so on. It is ab initio, so there's no input from experiment. There are no free parameters in the theory. And the point is not to avoid contact with experiment, but to have a method that's complementary to experiment. To have experiment over here and theory over here, and have them be independent of each other, and that gives you a lot more powerful comparisons between the two. So what goes into these calculations? Well, I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute, but in principle, all you have to put in are the positions and the charges of the nuclei, and everything else falls out. In fact, even the positions of the nuclei is usually relaxed, not completely, but to some extent relaxed by finding the locations of the nuclei that minimize the total energy. Well, it all sounds great, but like most theories applied to most interesting problems, it's not exact. And the question then is just how precise is it? And that answer can only come from comparison to experiment. And I'll show you some examples of that in a little bit. What's shown here, by the way, is one result of a density functional theory calculation. This is Stishovite again, which I showed you before, and sort of the Goldschmidt-Pauling picture and an experimental map of the charge density. Here's a theoretically calculated charge density of Stishovite. We have the silicon ion in the middle and the oxygen ions surrounding it. And you see that the oxygen ions are actually quite distorted. And that distortion is going to change your picture of what kind of bonding it is. It's clearly not purely ionic, otherwise the oxygen ions would be spherical. And this is going to affect physical properties, equation of state, elasticity, and so on.
you get all the properties that you want?
Yes. Yeah, in principle, you can calculate anything. In practice, there are, you're limited by computer time. And I'll try to give you a sense of what calculations are fast and have appeared in the literature a lot, and which calculations won't be done for a while. Okay, so I want to say a little bit more about density functional theory, but first I have to introduce a few more concepts. And we're going to look at solids now from yet another perspective, which is a really bizarre perspective, and it will turn out to be not a very good approximation at all for the Earth, but it will give us some insight into what goes into density functional theory in the first place. All right, we're going to do something really bizarre. We're going to say that Earth materials don't consist of ions at all. We're going to go to the opposite extreme and say that they consist of nuclei, okay, bare nuclei, sitting in a sea of uniform electron density. Okay, so there's no relationship between electrons and nuclei in this picture. There are no atoms, no ions. You just have this uniform sea of electrons, and nuclei sort of stuck in like raisins. Okay. Before we get to the properties of that, let's look at the properties of another material that has a uniform spatial distribution of particles, and that is the ideal gas. In the ideal gas, you have these atoms zipping around, and on average, there's no preference for atoms to occupy one piece of space over another, right? So you can think of the distribution of atoms as being uniform. And in that case, the pressure is linearly related to the density of atoms. That's just the ideal gas law, written in slightly different form from what you usually see. Now let's think about the uniform distribution of electrons. In the ideal gas, the energy is purely kinetic. And if we look at the uniform distribution of electrons and just look at the kinetic contribution to the pressure, we see that, first of all, we can solve it exactly. That it just involves all these fundamental constants and the charge density here. Second, that the expression for the pressure does differ slightly from the ideal gas law. In the exponent here, instead of an exponent of 1, we have an exponent of 5/3. And the reason for that is that the kinetic energy of the electrons goes like the length scale of your system. In fact, the inverse of the length scale. That's back to the de Broglie relation. So as you shrink your box, the kinetic energy of the electrons increases. And that's a contribution that doesn't exist in the ideal gas. Other contributions to the energy, which you can also write down exactly for this very simple case, are the exchange and correlation energies, and also the interaction between ions and electrons. Okay, so if you do all that, we'll come back to exchange and correlation in particular in a minute. Exchange and correlation describe the tendency of electrons to avoid each other at a local scale. Electrons have the same charge, obviously, and so as they're swimming around this uniform charge density soup here, they're tending to avoid each other a little bit because they're repelling each other coulombically. That's correlation. Exchange expresses the tendency of electrons of the same spin to avoid each other because of the Pauli exclusion principle. And so that's another contribution to the energy. All right, so you can calculate this model exactly, what the equation of state is, and this is the results. And first we have to sort of translate planets into the language of this model, because the equation of state depends on Z, that is the charge on the nuclei. So take 1 for Jupiter, corresponding to hydrogen, 10 for the mantle, corresponding to mean atomic weight of 21 or so, 26 for the core. And that simple model then is given by these dashed lines for those values of Z. And here's Jupiter and the Earth on this log-log plot. And this model is really bad for the Earth. It's terrible for the Earth. So this is comparable to this. We're off by an order of magnitude, also for the core. For Jupiter, we're not doing nearly as badly. And perturbations to this calculation that I just showed you are commonly applied to understanding the interiors of giant planets and even more so stars. And one way to understand the differences here is in terms of the basic assumption of the model, the uniform charge density. What happens is that the calculated density is too high. And one way to understand that is to think about the differences between that idealized model and a real material where the electrons tend to be much more concentrated around the nuclei. That tends to screen the nuclear charge, and it tends to expand the lattice then, to reduce the Coulomb attraction that's keeping the lattice together, and the lattice ends up expanding. And that effect of the electrons sort of crowding around, concentrating around the nuclei, reducing their effective charge, is what's known as screening. And so what this comparison tells us is that that screening and the inhomogeneity of charge density is going to be really important at least at Earth pressures, maybe not so much at stellar pressures. Temperature is a minor contributor to this. It would shift things around by a bit more than the thickness of the line, but not too much more than that. Okay, so back to density functional theory with that background. What is it? Well, we start from an equation which looks a lot like the Schrödinger equation. We have a Laplacian here. Which gives us the kinetic energy. We have a potential here. We have a wave function. We have an energy and the wave function again on this side of the equation. All right, so it looks a lot like the Schrödinger equation. It's not quite the same, and the way it differs is in the potential. In the case of the one electron atom, we just had minus Z on R, and it was trivial, and we can write it down analytically. In the case of the solid, we can't write it down analytically, because of the electron-electron interactions, which are complicated and we don't know the form of them. So in principle, to calculate the electron-electron interactions, you'd have to know the wave function of every single electron in your material. The insight that that Kahn and Sham and Hohenberg had was to sort of recast the problem. They said, wait a minute, we don't need to know all this detail about the wave function of every electron. That's going to be impossible anyway. We can prove that the ground state internal energy is a unique functional of a much simpler object, the charge density. The charge density is just a scalar function of position. All right, so you don't need to know about every electron that goes into the charge density for every point. You just need to know about sort of the integral of this. You just need to know the charge density at every point. It's also sort of appealing because the charge density is experimentally observable, and it's also the central quantity in this theory, although that connection isn't essential. We don't need the experimental charge density to do the calculations. And so this potential energy here then is also a unique functional of the charge density, which is really nice. And so you can write down a contribution from the nucleus. This is just the minus Z over R term that we had before. Interactions between the nuclei and the electrons, which just goes like the charge density of the electrons. Actually, this is the electron-electron interaction here. And we have another term here where all the complicated many-body interactions between the electrons are stored. In here is the exchange contribution to the energy and the correlation contribution to the energy that I mentioned before. And that's also a functional of the charge density, like everything else in the problem. These terms are easy to calculate. It's just computer time. They're straightforward to calculate. This one is really hard to calculate, and we don't know the exact functional form of this guy. So all the approximations end up getting piled into this one term here called the exchange correlation potential or exchange correlation functional. And so the only essential approximation in density functional theory calculations is to this exchange correlation functional. And the simplest approximation also turns out to be probably the most useful and most accurate. And that is to say, all right, so I go into my crystal to a particular point. I interrogate the charge density, and I say that the exchange and correlation potential at that point are the same as that of a uniform electron gas with that charge density. All right, so it's a local approximation in the sense that the exchange and correlation potential at any point just depends on the charge density at that point. And I know what the exchange and correlation terms are for a uniform electron gas, so I can substitute those for every point in the crystal. And so we're taking into account the inhomogeneity and the charge density, not only in the easy terms, but also in the hard term here in the exchange correlation potential. You can do fancier things. You can allow the exchange and correlation potentials to depend not only on the local charge density, but also on local charge density gradients, and all kinds of even messier things. Yes?
The square brackets indicate that it's a functional, right?
Yes.
So the V is potential.
Mm-hmm.
So the second term is just charge density, has just the units of charge density, right?
Yes.
So are dimensionally the same as?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, yeah, would have units of, end up having units of charge over R, I guess. Yeah. Well, this is integral over three-dimensional space, so it goes like R cubed. Yeah. So it's a volume element, in other words, not just a distance element. You have to guess. It ends up being an iterative process, and that's a good question. You can make any guess you want. You can assume a uniform charge density to start. You can assume overlapping ions. In principle, it doesn't matter. So what you do is you guess at the charge density. All right. You calculate all this, substitute it in there, solve for the wave function, solve for the energies for that initial guess of the charge density. Then calculate the new charge density from your wave functions. And then recalculate this, the potential, and then recalculate the wave function. Until it converges. Yeah, until it stops changing, right. So you keep going back and forth between charge density, potential. Yes. That's turns out to be the most efficient choice for most mantle materials. You just start with overlapping, spherically symmetric, fully charged ions. Yeah.
Presumably the real estate is not perturbed too much on that, so that's
forever. Right. And the convergence, and even if you start from a uniform charge density, which in principle should be very far away, which is very far away, the convergence isn't that much slower, maybe a factor of 3 or 4 slower. Okay, so self-consistency. This is a self-consistent theory. There are other non-self-consistent theories, of which Gordon Kim is one, actually. All right, so a little bit more about the computational methods. So this is the only essential approximation. There are other approximations that are made, but these aren't essential. And I've done calculations and other people have done calculations that don't have this additional approximation in it. And these accurate as possible calculations are called all electron calculations. The pseudopotential approximation has a very simple motivation, and it speeds up the computations by like an order of magnitude or more. And the basic idea is that all of bonding, all of chemistry, all equations of state, at least at Earth pressures, are determined entirely by the valence electrons. As all these changes are going on, the core electrons are so tightly bound to the nucleus that they're just oblivious to all this good stuff that's going on. So you solve for the core electrons once and be done with them. And what that allows you to do is to replace the potential due to the nucleus, which goes like minus Z over R, right? Here it is, a dashed line here for oxygen, shooting down to minus infinity at the origin. It allows you to replace what would be called a hard potential, because it's varying so rapidly, that's what hard means, with a much softer potential called the pseudopotential, which is due not to the bare nucleus now, but to the nucleus plus the surrounding core electrons. So you're screening the nucleus, essentially, and finding out what effective potential the valence electrons are seeing due to this combined nucleus plus core electron object. And these are what the pseudopotentials look like for P and S electrons in oxygen. They're much softer. And what that allows you to do is to represent the charge density and potential in your calculation with plane waves. And plane waves are really computationally fast to work with. The alternative might be sort of atomic-like states, right? You could use as your basis set to represent this charge density, you could use S orbitals, P orbitals, D orbitals, and so on. There are two problems with that. One is that they're computationally slow. You have to integrate over this very complicated object at every step. Two, the basis set doesn't have nice convergence properties. You can add F shells and G orbitals and all and polarization functions, all kinds of odd things, and the results keep changing. The plane wave basis set is complete and orthogonal, and you can demonstrate convergence very very nicely and very cleanly. Yes, those are the pseudopotentials seen by the P electrons in oxygen and by the S electrons in oxygen. Okay, so let me show you a few examples. Now, in the next lab, you're going to do some first principles calculations, and you'll take a pseudopotential code, density functional theory code, and apply it to MgSO3 perovskite, and calculate at least one point on the equation of state and a couple of elastic constants. And this runs on the Mac now, and this is a huge difference, obviously, from when I first started doing these calculations, when you had to use supercomputers to do even the simplest calculation. But the algorithms have gotten faster, and of course computers have gotten a lot faster too. So now you can actually do interesting things on a Mac. And you'll see that. Let me give you a few examples to finish up. Very quickly, potassium, my advisor, is one of the pioneers in this field. Actually the pioneer in geophysics, and one of the things he did was to look at the electronic structure of potassium as you went up in pressure. And the interesting thing he found is that potassium becomes more and more like a transition metal as you compress it, right? The amount of compression is sufficient to dramatically alter the electronic structure, in other words. And if you think about it, it's not that odd. If you look at the periodic table, potassium and then, yeah, from your point of view, potassium, calcium, and then the 3D transition metals. So potassium isn't very far away from that transition metal series. Besides that, the S electron is in this huge, fluffy orbital that becomes less and less favorable as you compress the material. And so the electrons, after a certain point, tend to jump from that huge, fluffy 4S orbital down into the 3D orbitals, which are much more localized, much more tightly compacted towards the nucleus. And this has implications for how potassium behaves during core formation, for example. We usually think of potassium as a lithophile. Can it become a siderophile at high pressure? This is an example of a structural transition in a mantle phase calcium silicate perovskite. And what we did was to do lattice dynamics from first principles on calcium silicate perovskite. We talked about lattice dynamics in the last lecture. Basically, what you need to know are the interatomic forces, and then you can solve for all the vibrational modes in the crystal. And so this is what a full phonon spectrum looks like for a real crystal, calcium silicate perovskite. You have the three acoustic branches here, two of them are degenerate along that direction. And then the optic modes at higher frequencies there. And we assumed the cubic structure of calcium silicate perovskite, and the interesting thing we found was that along certain wave vectors, the frequencies were actually imaginary. What that corresponds to is a vibrational mode without a restoring force. I mean, most vibrational modes go out and then they come back again. This is a vibrational mode that goes out and then keeps going out and just stays there. So this, you can show that this corresponds to a change in the structure of the material, and we predicted this non-cubic distortion, and recently it was confirmed experimentally. The splitting of this peak right here is the signature of the non-cubic distortion. And this might be important for understanding the elasticity of this phase in the mantle. Some stuff that Wendy Pinero has done on looking at incorporation of hydrogen into the stishovite structure, coupling it with aluminum, and she was actually able to calculate the solubility of water in stishovite from first principles, assuming this particularly simple incorporation mechanism, and that it agreed reasonably well with the available data, and to extrapolate it to higher pressures. And I'll stop there. Yeah. That's a very interesting question, and Mark actually looked at that at about the same time he did these calculations. The way he approached it was to compute from first principles the charge density at the nucleus and assume that the probability of electron capture would be inversely proportional to that charge density. As you go up in pressure, that charge density reduces, and so the probability of capture, I guess, would increase. And so that would lead to a change in the decay constant with pressure. But he showed that the change was very small, actually. Yes, he did. And the change, I don't remember what the changes were. Maybe they were a few percent. The one thing that you would like to do better, and this is something Kanani Lee is doing with Gerrit Stein-Lenoyman, a former student of mine, is to put potassium in a geologically more relevant environment. So Mark looked at pure potassium, elemental potassium, and what you'd like to do is to put a small amount of potassium in solution with iron or in solution in a silicate, and see how those results change. And as far as I know, nobody's looked at that decay constant issue again yet. Yeah.
Could you just give an idea of what kind of computer
you're
talking about?
Yeah. For the calculations that you'll do in the lab, it should run in a couple minutes.
To do something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it completely depends on the property that you're most interested in calculating. Say you want to calculate the equation of state at static conditions, at zero temperature. The size of the calculation depends entirely on the size of the unit cell of the crystal. So for a perovskite, that happens to be 20 atoms. And that's not too bad. For something like garnet, it's 160 atoms, and so that's going to be slower by a factor of 8 cubed. Because like the number of atoms cubed. There are other properties that effectively extend the size of your unit cell. And this is an example of such a property. Say you want to look at how the energetics of incorporating hydrogen into stishovite. The amount of hydrogen is going to be small. So if you want to calculate the energy of stishovite with one part per million hydrogen, say, in principle you need a unit cell that's a million times larger than the stishovite unit cell, and that's going to be impossible. So what Wendy did was to focus on larger concentrations of hydrogen than they're probably relevant geophysically, and to assume that the energetics are linear with hydrogen incorporation over that range. So this is the unit cell that she used here, which is larger than the primitive Stishovite unit cell by a factor of 4 or so, I think. And so that slows the calculation. So basically it comes down to the size of the unit cell. And sometimes you need to use something larger than the primitive unit cell. Yeah?
Can you give us a sense of how well the calculation matches the elastic?
Yeah, you'll get a chance to do this for yourself in the tutorial. Elastic constants agree with experiment to within a few percent. Density is also typically to maybe a percent or so. It depends a bit on the material. These methods fortunately turn out to work very well for magnesium silicates. Phase transitions is something that we haven't looked at very closely yet. There are lots of things that we haven't explored yet, but for sort of equation of state elasticity, the agreement turns out to be very good.
What's the future of this? Because, you know, now we've got some
Yeah, there are several directions. One is improvements in the theory. That exchange correlation potential is the one approximation we have to make. There are ways to get at it nearly exactly. They're called quantum Monte Carlo. And some people are working on that now. It's going to be a long time before quantum Monte Carlo calculations make any impact in geophysics. But computers are going to keep getting faster. And so eventually they will. And so eventually that approximation also will drop away. The other advances will come in simulating more complex systems. One more complex system that's of particular interest geophysically is a crystal at high temperature. And one way to think about the distinction between a zero temperature crystal and a high temperature crystal is that at zero temperature, the translational symmetry is perfect. At high temperature, every atom is vibrating, and we saw how complicated these vibrational modes can be. And so every snapshot of the crystal at high temperature has completely broken translational symmetry. And so what you've done is to increase the size of your calculation. And so that's a direction that these calculations will go towards simulating high temperature properties. And right now on my Mac I have running first principles molecular dynamics simulation of a silicate liquid. And so that's a really messy system where you have to use a very large unit cell. But that's also something we can do on modern computers. Yeah?
Oh.
No, sorry. Yeah?
When you bring two hydrogen atoms with the same spin, what's the
difference? One of them would change spin if you're forming this molecular state, this sort of two electron molecular state. Yeah, an upspin and a downspin. And that transition, by the way, that I showed from metallic hydrogen to covalent hydrogen is exactly what we think happens in Jupiter and Saturn as you go into the interior. About 10% of the way down, you go from covalently bonded H2 molecules to metallic hydrogen, as far as we can tell. And then that has important implications for how the magnetic field is generated and so on. Yeah?
Well, I was just going to ask. So first principle calculations for environments such as inner core, is this sort of getting now where the results are relied upon?
Well, relied upon. I mean, we make predictions, and of course the ultimate test is experimental measurement. I mean, we know the theory isn't exact, and so all we can do is to compare it to experimental measurement. And where we make those comparisons, the results are good. Now, at inner core pressures, the experimental data are limited. We can compare to the equation of state. That works out pretty well, to the Hugoniot and so on. And we have predicted elastic constants in the inner core. And as far as we can tell, assuming we did the calculations properly, that the results should be as reliable as the other elastic constants that we've calculated. And they make predictions about the anisotropy of iron and how you can arrange the crystals to produce the sort of first order anisotropy of the inner core. So are they reliable or not? I mean, we'd like to think that they're reliable, but again, the ultimate test is a comparison to experiment. There's really no way to do it a priori. Again, you just have to compare it case by case. Does this match observations? Does that matter? Iron is an interesting case because the local density approximation does fail in important ways for iron, and we do have to go beyond it to one that includes the gradients, the local gradients. And the most important failure is in the BCC to HCP phase transition. LD actually predicts the close pack structure to be more stable at ambient conditions, whereas GGA gets the phase transition just about perfectly. And so you do have to worry about some of these things. I mean, transition metals are messier. The d electrons are harder to treat. And so so you might have expected a priori that you would need something fancier for transition metals. But the real reason that we do it is that because they, doing something else doesn't work. Yeah?
So what can you do with liquids?
With liquids, what you do is you have to treat liquids one snapshot at a time. So what you do is you put 100 atoms or so in a box, translationally repeat it to avoid edge effects, and then monitor the locations of the nuclei at every time step and the forces acting on those nuclei, and run Newton's equations of motion forward, calculating the forces by solving the full Schrödinger equation at every time step. And so what you get are a series of snapshots of locations of nuclei. And you, in the meantime, at every snapshot, you're calculating things like energy and pressure and so on. So you can get equation of state of liquids. In principle, you could get shear properties of liquids. You can get structure of liquids, anything you like in principle. It's slow, of course, because you have to deal with a lot of atoms. Otherwise, you're not really reproducing the complexity of the liquid structure.
Well, I mean, in that case, it would be nice to know going on with melting. Right now, we have melts, which is basically just a kind of maybe not even optimal fit to the experiment today. And considering, has there been any attempt to sort of, you've got this program now to calculate the solid state at equal energy. At what stage will be able to say, well, you know, what's, when's the liquid,
Yeah, I mean, I could do right now what Mark Iorso has done and put in the liquids, and it would be valid over a very limited range of pressure and temperature because we don't know very much beyond that very limited range. I think what's needed are either more experiments, like Hugonio experiments, or the kind of first principles molecular dynamics simulations to get an idea of what the liquids do at higher pressures, 10 GPa, 20 GPa, lower mantle pressures. Be nice to know all that. And the other thing that's very important, actually, is to understand the energetics of mixing in silicate liquids. This is something that we know virtually nothing about. And it's really important because if you just think of sort of simple-minded mixing models, then your answer depends on the mixing species that you choose. So you get different answers, whether you choose MgO and SiO2 versus Mg2SO4 and MgSO3. And that, of course, is kind of disastrous, that your results depend on arbitrary choices like that, and you'd like to avoid that. Right. Right, so the regular solution energetics are purely empirical in his model, as I understand it. Just, you know, what does it take to fit phase equilibrium data? And yeah, it'd be nice to do better than that. I mean, there are a few experimental results now doing calorimetry of sort of the energetics of mixing of quenched liquids, of course. But this is actually, theoretically, is one way to probe it much more directly and to look at how the energetic changes are related to structural changes in the liquid too, and try to develop some intuition and understanding of what these terms are. We are. No, it's something that hadn't been contemplated before with first principle. So we decided, you know, the time is ripe. We've got the computer power. Let's do it. So. Yes. Yes. Another example of a calculation that would involve a very large system. Say you want to do defective perovskite, put in one point defect. The size of your calculation would become large because you don't want those point defects to interact with their periodically repeated images. To something like simulating a dislocation from first principles, I think is something that could take a very long time because the interaction between dislocations decays only like the logarithm of the distance. So you need a very, very large unit cell to probe that. So deformation, anelasticity, rheology, those sorts of things have barely been touched with these sorts of methods. And it may be some time before they are, realistically. All right.